after John got his driver's license. Able to reach more clients, he and John Bellotti began to lend out tens of thousands of dollars. They didn't believe they were hurting anyone, and they were good at it. Brimming with confidence, the two friends began investing in legitimate businesses, and even purchased an after-hours club they were too young by law to enter themselves. By 17, John was making more money than the principal of his school. Still, he never missed a shift at his dad's butcher shop. John used some of that money to sign up for weekend dive charters to dangerous shipwrecks in New York and New Jersey waters. Though he could drive himself, he always asked his father to take him. It was fun to share the adventure, to be on the way to important places together. Driving home from the docks, John's father pressed him for details. He wanted to know everything that had happened underwater. Often, John Sr. knew more about the history of the wreck or the details of her sinking than anyone on the charter. John loved that about his father, but it made him ache for his dad, too. "Take diving lessons and go with me to the wrecks," he'd say, and his dad would always answer, "Oh, man, I'd love to, pal. When I get the time, I will." But John knew better. His father had a family to support, and Maddie's quality meats couldn't run without Maddie. So the best John could do was to keep telling his father the stories and to leave in all the details. While John was putting money on the streets, his classmates were choosing colleges. He'd thought about it too, but was disappointed by his transcript. All average, except for history, for which he'd received A's. But John knew that people didn't go to college on history alone. After graduation, he bought a white 1971 Ford Mustang Boss 351, his dream car. One morning he used it to take his father to breakfast at their favorite luncheonette, Gene and Tony's. After the meal, the Mustang wouldn't start. John asked his dad to give the car a push so he could start it with the clutch. When John got rolling, he looked in the rearview mirror to see his dad bent over, huffing and puffing. Anne took her husband to doctors, and they arrived at a diagnosis. Lung cancer. John was floored by the news. Though he smoked three packs a day, John's dad was only 46 and had always been strong and fit. John had no doubt his father would beat it. They went back to the butcher shop, the two of them, every day. For a few months, his dad seemed fine, and that made sense to John. He'd seen cancer up close, in chunks of beef that looked normal until you opened them up and saw huge yellow sacks inside. And in those cases, you just wrapped the meat back up, called the guy who delivered it, and sent it back. But then his father started losing weight. He died early in 1981, at age 47. John was 18. He didn't cry at the funeral. He just looked out at the world, knowing it was finally too late for his father to have an adventure, and nothing seemed in color anymore. John Matera took over his father's butcher shop, but he no longer cut meat with precision. For years, people had known him for his perpetual smile. Now, he mostly stared at the ground. 4 months later, his mother sold the shop. People began to steer clear of Matera. One who did not was Tommy Bellotti, the father of his friend. Whenever Matera stopped by the house, Tommy would put his arm around him, inquire after his mother, ask if there was anything he could do for the family. Sometimes he'd put a few $100s in Matera's pocket, but when Matera tried to pay him back, he'd only say, "Get out of here before I hit you." By now, Tommy lived in a 12,000-square-foot waterfront mansion. Matera and John Bellotti grew closer, becoming best friends. Their money-lending business grew. If anyone accused them of stealing customers, they issued this response, "I don't give a fuck for you." If anyone pressed harder, Matera would say, "Do something about it." Almost no one did. One exception came when Matera was 20. After he got into a beef with a 26-year-old Gambino associate, the nephew of a made guy from another of the New York crime families. A few days later, Matera found his apartment broken into and his guns, all legally owned, stolen. He countered by breaking into the apartment of the man he'd argued with. There, he found every one of his guns, along with $40,000 in cash. He took it all. Not long after, the man and two of his partners grabbed Matera at gunpoint and took him to a closed-down Fine Fair supermarket. Pushing him into a meat locker, they tied him to a chair and put a gun to his head. "Where is the money?"
"What money?"
The men began punching and kicking Matera.
"Where is the fucking money?"
They knocked Matera over in his chair and began stomping his head, throwing him into walls and kneeing his face until Matera was sure they would kill him.
"Where is our goddamn money?
Go fuck yourselves." One of the men pulled out a 9mm Smith & Wesson Model 59.
"I'm dead," Matera thought.
But instead of pulling the trigger, the man raised the gun in the air, then brought it down behind Matera's ear. Blood oozed onto the meat locker floor. Another man pulled out a stun gun and shocked Matera. Then he called to his friends.
"Get the bat."
The man left the room. Lying in a pool of his own blood, Matera thought,
"If they were going to kill me, I'd be dead already. So when I get out of here, they're finished."
The men didn't return. A nearby store owner came in with a bag of ice, put Matera in a taxi, and sent the driver to the hospital. In the emergency room, doctors stitched up Matera and told him he was lucky to be alive. John Bellotti picked him up a few hours later.
"My father wants to see you," he said.
By now, Tommy Bellotti was acting underboss of the Gambino family, the second highest position in the organization, and running much of Staten Island, parts of Brooklyn and Manhattan, and the docks. At his front door, he stared at the turban of bandages on Matera's head and asked his wife to excuse them.
"Tell me what happened and don't fucking lie to me. Were you dealing drugs?"
"I swear, Tommy, never."
"Don't fucking lie to me."
"Tommy, I swear, no drugs. He broke into my house, I broke into his house."
"And you took 150 grand from him."
"No, I got 40,000.
"What else did you get?"
"My guns."
"You found your guns in there?"
"Yeah."
"Okay, I'll take care of it."
Matera knew this was supposed to be the end of the conversation, but he couldn't leave it there.
"Tommy, with all due respect, this is something I need to take care of myself."
Bellotti thought it over.
"Okay," he said. "But I'm going to tell you two things. First, I want you to make a measured response. Don't go crazy. Don't kill anyone. Don't fuck up your life. Second, when you're better, I'm going to kick the shit out of you, because that's what your father would do."
Matera's father, in fact, never would have hit him, but it touched Matera that Tommy was trying to help in a fatherly way. Matera got up to leave. Tommy called after him.
"Measured response."
On the 4th of July, Matera found out that the man who'd stolen his guns and beat him was going to be watching fireworks with his fiancée near the beach. In late afternoon, Matera got into John Bellotti's Cadillac and the two men drove to the site. By the time they arrived, it was dusk. No one said a word as Matera moved through the crowd carrying a baseball bat. He found the guy drinking Sambuca with friends.
"What the—"
the man said at the sight of Matera, but before he could finish, Matera hit him in the mouth with the bat, knocking out all of his teeth and breaking his jaw and cheekbone. Matera reached back to hit him again, but feared he'd already exceeded a measured response. He dropped the bat and walked back to the car. Police arrived a few minutes later. Though it had happened in front of hundreds of people, no one had seen a thing. 2 weeks later, the man's uncle contacted Tommy Bellotti and arranged for a sit-down. The meeting was set for a Staten Island pizzeria owned by the man Matera had pummeled. That man would be represented by his uncle. Matera would be represented by Tommy. The sit-down occurred a few weeks later. Matera, John, and Tommy were led to the back of the pizzeria, which was decorated in glass and mirrors, the furniture in salmon leather.
"Disgusting," Tommy said. "This is Staten Island, not the inside of I Dream a Genie's bottle."
The injured man spoke first, counting off Matera's offenses. Matera did the same. Then the made guy spoke.
"Tommy, I think a certain amount of restitution has to be made here,"
the uncle said.
"This kid stole a lot of money and did a lot of damage. He needs a big-time beating. What's right is right."
Bellotti thought it over.
"I'll tell you what's going to happen," he said. This pizzeria your nephew owns, it's closed now. That arcade he owns, I own that now. This is your relative, you like him, you take him. He goes back to New York with you. This day is the last day he's on Staten Island. If I see him here again, you can come after me because I'm going to kill him. And anything the Matera kid took is his.
The uncle seethed, but knew Tommy was within his rights, according to the unwritten and ancient laws of organized crime. Matera could hardly believe it. He was at the center of a quintessential mob sit-down like he'd seen in the movies. And he'd won. A few months later, Matera dropped by the Bellotti house. Tommy, as always, asked him in for breakfast. In the kitchen, Tommy fried an omelet, put bread in the toaster, and then, swinging from the ground up, hit Matera across the face with an open hand, leaving him sprawling and dazed on the floor.
"That's the beating I owed you," Tommy said. "Your dad didn't want you in trouble. Now pick yourself up and eat eggs."
Matera's business expanded rapidly after that, and though he was young, single, and flush with cash, the darkness of his father's passing still hung over him. At night he wrote letters to Lloyd's of London requesting copies of registries for missing ships they'd insured. His happiest days were when packages arrived, postmarked in colorful stamps from England, stuffed with pages of clues as to where some of these ships might be found. Not long after Matera turned 22, he roughed up a tough guy who'd stolen money from him. Word on the street was that the guy had a gun and was looking for him, so Matera made sure he had a gun too. They found each other on McLean Avenue. From a distance of 10 yards, the man drew his weapon and started firing at Matera, and Matera responded in kind. Each man emptied his gun, somehow missing the other. Then they began punching, and even as he landed blows, Matera thought, "What am I doing here? Where am I going to end up in this life?" But whenever he made a move to get out, by opening an auto towing company or his own butcher shop, he drifted back to his lending business. It was then that Tommy Bellotti was promoted again, from acting to full underboss, just under the big boss, Paul Castellano. If ever there was an opportunity to make big money, that time was now. Still, neither John Matera nor John Bellotti made a move to expand. Matera continued to run the new butcher shop he'd opened, and it was there, in mid-December 1985, that a friend rushed in and told him that Tommy Bellotti had been killed in Midtown Manhattan, shot in cold blood outside Sparks Steakhouse, along with Paul Castellano. It was an audacious assassination in front of New Yorkers doing their Christmas shopping. Newscasters were calling it the biggest mob hit since the 1929 St. Valentine's Day massacre. Matera took off his apron, grabbed a Browning high-power 9mm pistol from the meat locker and closed shop. He drove to Tommy's house, found John inside, and put his arm around him. For the next 8 hours, he stood by the door with his weapon and waited, ready to protect his friend in case anyone had ideas about hurting another Bellotti. Shortly after the murders, John Bellotti was called in for a sit-down with Sammy the Bull Gravano, the new underboss of the Gambino family. War was breaking out, and word had it that John Gotti, who had ordered the killings of Castellano and Bellotti and was the new boss, wanted to make peace with those who might have a grudge against him. Many viewed John Bellotti as a fine mind and loyal son who was not likely to allow his father's murder to go unavenged. The way Matera and Bellotti saw it, there were only two potential outcomes from a sit-down with Gravano. Bellotti would be killed, or he would become a made member of the family. Bellotti could not decide which of the two he preferred least. So, he decided not to show. The decision would displease Gotti, so Matera and Bellotti went on the lam. For months, they moved between rural Pennsylvania, upstate New York, and Staten Island, never staying in one place for more than a day, never going anywhere without weapons. On the road, they discussed baseball and cars, dated girls, and drew up plans for new businesses. Again, Gravano urged Bellotti to come in for a sit-down. That's when Matera and Bellotti had a serious talk. A life in organized crime, or even on its fringes, rarely ended well. One after another, neighborhood guys went to jail or wound up buried in the sand flats or lived in constant fear. So, yes, if Bilotti sat down with Gravano, there was a chance he would be killed. But there was also a chance the Gambinos would listen when he said that he and Matera wanted nothing to do with the life. A sit-down was scheduled. Bilotti would not swear allegiance to Gotti, nor would he ask to be made. He would simply deliver his message. He wanted out. On the night of the meeting, Matera and another friend armed themselves heavily in case the worst happened. They would follow Bilotti to the sit-down and wait outside. If Bilotti came out at the end of the meeting, they would all go for pizza. If he did not, Matera and his friend would go in with guns blazing. A tan Cadillac picked up Bilotti and set out toward Brooklyn. Matera and his friend followed in the distance. They lost the caddy going over the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, but picked it up again at the 92nd Street exit, then followed to a small bar in Brooklyn called the 19th Hole. Bilotti and three men walked into the bar. A half hour passed. Then an hour. Matera's friend wanted to go in shooting, but Matera held him back. Maybe the men were still talking. Finally, four figures emerged and got into the tan Cadillac, but in the dark, Matera couldn't tell whether one of them was Bilotti. So Matera and his friend followed the car. Near 86th Street, the Cadillac pulled over. Matera's heart pounded. All he wanted now was to see his friend's face. But no one was moving in that car. Then he heard a click. Slowly, a door on the caddy swung open, and a man got out. He began walking, quickly, toward Matera. Matera reached for his gun, but he recognized the man's gait. It was Bilotti.
"You almost got them to shoot you," Bilotti said, "but I love you."
"You okay?"
"Yeah, let's get pizza."
Crammed around a tiny table at Spumoni Gardens in Brooklyn, Bilotti told his friends what happened. He and Gravano had talked for more than an hour. Gravano told him the family couldn't function at war with itself. Guys were getting killed, and he wanted to make sure Bilotti wasn't involved. Bilotti looked into the eyes of one of the most feared killers in organized crime and said,
"I don't want any part of this business. My father didn't want me in this business. You leave my friends and my family out of it, and we have no intention of getting involved."
Gravano looked him up and down and said,
"Well then, it's done between us."
A few months later, Matera walked into Magnum Sports on Staten Island, the largest indoor shooting range in New York. He struck up a friendship with Pat Rogers, a 40-year-old detective sergeant in the New York City Police Department, and the best shooter Matera had seen. Rogers rarely missed, two rounds center mass almost every time, and he was smart and interesting, someone Matera could talk to. Rogers began mentoring Matera at the range. Five sharp every morning, the two of them cranking off hundreds of rounds until each was standing in brass. It wasn't long before the owner of Magnum offered Matera a job, for less in a month than he used to make in a day, and Matera took it. At the range one day, Matera helped a customer with a broken mainspring on his .45 automatic. No charge, happy to do it. The customer asked if Matera might be looking to become a police officer. A reasonable question, given the venue. Matera was intrigued by the idea. Of course, he presumed he'd never qualify given the life he'd led, but then he got to thinking. Despite all his capers, he'd never come under police scrutiny for anything more than a traffic violation. He showed up the next day at the West Hampton Beach police station on Long Island. The customer with the broken .45 turned out to be the town's chief of police. The man took Matera's photo and had him sign papers, then took him across the street to a courthouse, where a judge told Matera to raise his right hand and swear to uphold the laws of the state of New York.
"No one back on Staten Island is going to believe this," he thought. "Even I don't believe this."
He made the pledge. They handed him a badge and a police ID card and told him to report to the police academy in a month. Matera was a natural in the classroom. By graduation, he carried a 99 average and was named valedictorian. West Hampton Beach hired him on provisional status. There was a hiring freeze on full-time employees, but that wouldn't affect his hours or pay, and he took the job. Soon, he was out on the streets working a beat. Other cops didn't see what Matera did. If there were bad guys packing guns, Matera knew. If college kids were selling drugs, he knew. If a senior citizen out for a stroll was really casing a home in order to rob it, he knew. No one on Staten Island could believe he'd become a cop, made members of the Gambino family threw friendly punches into his arm and said, "What did we do wrong with you?" The one person who seemed most happy for him was John Bellotti.
"It doesn't surprise me,"
he told Matera, who picked him up one day and took him for pastries in his police car.
"You always could do whatever you wanted."
Matera loved being a cop, making pinches others missed, thinking like a bad guy in order to do good, and he did it for 2 years, until it became clear that due to the hiring freeze, he would always be provisional. By this time, however, he was thinking bigger about law enforcement. He went to live in Missouri and Arizona in order to learn from Jeff Cooper and Ray Chapman, the fathers of modern combat shooting. This was the Ivy League of gunfighting, and Matera took to it right away, and he made friends at the school. One of them, through contacts at government agencies, arranged for Matera to do covert work overseas, the kind that required a man who wouldn't flinch. Working as a contractor for the U.S. government, Matera traveled to Nicaragua, Turkey, Montenegro, and a dozen other high-risk countries, distributing propaganda, protecting shipments, and training security details. He worked mostly in war zones, always in the shadows. In his early 30s, he flew to a third-world country hostile to the United States to conduct covert surveillance. A contact he trusted there betrayed him, leaving him pinned in a burned-out building and surrounded by armed insurgents eager to collect the rich bounties paid for the heads of Americans. His only hope for survival was to make it back on foot to the American embassy, more than a mile away, but he didn't dare try it in daylight. So he passed the hours running through New York Mets lineups he'd memorized as a kid, and counting off the things he'd meant to do in life but hadn't yet made time for. When he needed to calm himself for his nighttime run, one he likely wouldn't survive, he thought about shipwrecks and of how beautiful it would be to find one that no one knew was there. After dark, Matera walked, slowly and purposefully, to the embassy. He waited for shots to ring out, but the road remained silent. 6 hours later, he was on a flight back to the States. On the government airplane, he kept his hand on his gun and promised himself that no matter what, he wouldn't put off until tomorrow what his heart told him to go for today. After Matera returned home, his uncle died of lung cancer, just as Matera's father had a decade earlier. People at the funeral tried to console him, but no matter what anyone did, Matera could not stop crying. It was the first time he'd cried since before his father died. By 1992, Matera had attended dozens of law enforcement-related specialty schools, covering everything from the operation of submachine guns to explosive room breaching to the latest in hostage negotiation. That year, he took a job with a security company in Virginia. He provided executive protection for CEOs, celebrities, and dignitaries, and he flourished. Soon he was earning at the top of the pay grade, all for doing what came naturally. He did this work for years, building a reputation and protecting the kinds of people who appeared on the cover of Time magazine. In 1998, Matera married Denise, a woman from Staten Island who had a 5-year-old daughter, Danielle. On his farm in Virginia, he would unroll a treasure map, really a plat of his property, put Danielle in his tractor and set out looking for gold. Time and again, they found foreign coins Matera had buried in advance, which thrilled the little girl. Once, after inspecting the date on a piece of treasure, she asked Matera why the coin was only 3 years old. "I don't know," he responded. "Treasure is a mysterious thing." By 2000, Matera had a baby daughter, Dana. Sensing that he could build something special for his family, he and a partner bought the security company outright. They had more work than they could handle, and soon, Matera was taking home more than $1 million a year. If a celebrity or CEO needed protection, Matera himself was available at rates that made him among the highest paid bodyguards in America. Now he could see the mountain. If he and his partner continued to push, there was no limit to where they could go. Giants in the industry put out feelers to see if Matera and his partner would sell. But Matera had long since made up his mind. Building this company was his chance to do something historic. There were costs, however, to doing it. He often worked 20-hour days. High-risk projects, his company's sweet spot, ate away at his stomach, making him dependent on a milkshake of Mylanta, Excedrin, and Advil. Tensions were building with Denise. When a buyout offer from a global security giant arrived in 2002, Matera and his partner listened. By putting his name to the contract, he would walk away with $3 million in cash, and the buyer would pay him a consulting salary. At age 40, he could live on the interest from his savings alone. The offer was generous, but the chance to build his business into something world-class was too rare for Matera to give up. His partner, however, wanted him to sell, and he wasn't the only one. Some of Matera's friends and family also urged him to get out, reminding him of people they knew who regretted not taking the sure thing. The buyer needed an answer. In a law firm conference room in Manhattan, Matera signed his name to a pile of papers, and in a moment, his company was gone. Walking the streets outside, not headed in any particular direction, he couldn't shake the sense that after a lifetime of challenging big worlds, he'd gone and sold himself short. His marriage, already strained, began breaking, and he and Denise separated. Even Matera's guns let him down. He took them to the range, but could never muster the will to unpack them. He waited for these feelings to pass, reminded himself of his good fortune. Yet, when it came time to drive his $125,000 Mercedes, he couldn't think of anywhere to go but Gene and Tony's, where he ordered the same bacon and egg on a roll he and his father had loved to eat there on Saturday mornings when John was a boy. As the months passed, it occurred to Matera that he might be chasing the wrong things in life. Money was great and success important, but at bottom he loved history. It was the one thing that spoke to him, and yet he'd never set out after it himself. He'd come close through the years by diving unexplored shipwrecks and solving small mysteries in great archives, but even then he was still one step removed, an observer looking back through the distance. What he really wanted, and had since grade school, was to do something historic himself, to add an enduring story of his own. He might have done that by rising to the top in organized crime, but he hadn't wanted to live a life of violence. He might have done it by taking his security company global. But what kid would want to read about that in 100 years? That's when he moved to the Dominican Republic. Diving the waters around Santo Domingo, he began to feel like himself again. He started Pirate's Cove, an exclusive resort for scuba divers. And he began dating Carolina Garcia. She loved history as much as Matera did. Soon, Matera came to love Carolina. And then he came up with a plan. He would set out in search of a galleon, a treasure ship loaded with gold and silver that had sailed between the New World and Spain in the 16th and 17th centuries. He bought a boat and equipment and did 1,000 hours of research. In 2006, he joined forces with Chatterton, the most driven and relentless person he'd ever met. Together, they pledged their savings to the project, which would make them rich and the toasts of the diving world. And then, on the eve of the search, he'd thrown it all over to look for a pirate ship. The sudden change of plans risked his treasure dreams and his savings. Political winds were blowing hard against salvors, and every week spent searching the seas cost thousands. But Matera had no choice. Finding a Golden Age pirate ship was rarer than stepping on the moon. Only one had ever been discovered and positively identified. But it was the pirate, even more than the ship, that took hold of him. To Matera, Joseph Bannister couldn't have become the most wanted man in the Caribbean and defeated the Royal Navy in battle without meaning to do something historic himself. And for that, Matera was willing to risk whatever it took to go find him. All that remained was to tell Carolina his plan. Over dinner, at a seaside restaurant, he told her all he knew about Bannister and the Golden Fleece, and he told her what the search could cost him. Carolina took his hand.
"I'm with you," she said. "I think you've been searching for this pirate for a very long time."
Chapter 10 The Oracles Matera flew back to Santo Domingo after his journey to the archive in Seville, but he didn't go on to Samana to rejoin his team. Instead, he made phone calls to old men in America, living legends of treasure hunting, who knew things a person couldn't learn from books. He doubted that any of them had chased a pirate before. These men lived for silver and gold. But he believed in wisdom and experience, and in that way, they were oracles to him. Soon, he had appointments to see the best of them. He flew to Florida and checked into a hotel in Key Largo. At a lobby kiosk, he saw a brochure for the Pirate's Soul Museum in Key West. "See real pirate treasures from the Golden Age. No quarter given." Matera stuffed the flyer into his pocket. Key West was 100 miles to the south. He had people to see the next day. But pirates were calling. So he started driving. Standing in line outside the museum, he took in the passing parade of bohemians, artists, and tourists. To him, Key West was laid back and glorious, a place he could live for up to a week before going crazy and needing something to do. He paid the $13.95 entry fee and walked back in time. In the first few rooms, he saw authentic pirate swords, pistols, treasure, cannons, rum bottles, and tools, including a gruesome amputation kit. The museum even had a globule of quicksilver, mercury, captured from pirates and entombed in a small jar of water. All of it dated to the Golden Age of piracy, between 1650 and 1720. But the rarest items were still to come. Hanging on one wall, ominously lit, was an original Jolly Roger, the infamous skull and crossbones flag flown by pirates, and one of only two known surviving examples in the world. Near it lay the only pirate treasure chest in America, complete with hidden compartments and belonging to Captain Thomas Tew, number 3 on Forbes magazine's list of the 20 highest-earning pirates, estimated career earnings $103 million, who was said to have been disemboweled and killed by a cannon shot during battle. On another wall, Matera saw an authentic English proclamation from 1696, offering £500 for the head of pirate Henry Avery. The piece was likely the oldest wanted poster in existence. The museum had been put together by Pat Croce, the former owner of the Philadelphia 76ers, from his personal collection. "This guy might love basketball," Matera thought as he stood before a 1684 first edition copy of Excumillon's The Buccaneers of America. "But he loves pirates more." Matera didn't leave until he'd read about the great pirates, and they all lived here. Morgan, Blackbeard, Kidd, Anne Bonny, Black Sam Bellamy, Calico Jack Rackham. Each one's career seemed more thrilling than the last. Yet, walking out the door into the blinding Key West sun, Matera couldn't help but smile, because he knew a pirate captain who could top them all. The next day, Matera walked into Manny and Issa's restaurant in Isla Morada, about 25 miles south of Key Largo, and shook hands with a quiet, slightly built, 80-year-old man named Jack Haskins. Few names were better known in the treasure business, yet Haskins had never been the classic treasure hunter. A researcher first, he had done work that had led to the discovery of some of the greatest Spanish galleons ever found. In talking to others about treasure, Matera always heard the same things about Haskins. First, that he knew more about finding old shipwrecks than anyone in the world. Second, that he was a decent and honest man, a rarity in the business. And third, that he'd been taken advantage of throughout his career. Haskins recommended the conch chowder, and the two men got to talking. In treasure, he said, information was paramount. A person could own the latest technology, operate the finest boat, and have the deepest pockets. But little of that mattered without knowing where to look. And that always came down to research. Haskins' own research had begun in Seville at the General Archive of the Indies, the place from which Matera had just returned. As a young man, he'd made a pilgrimage there, armed only with an English-Spanish dictionary and a hunger to find a galleon. And over the next few years, made himself fluent in the archaic language and script that told the story of the great Spanish treasure fleets. Soon, treasure hunters began paying Haskins to do research in Seville. He stayed for weeks at a time, completing assignments, then copying thousands of other documents, some of them seemingly at random, until he'd built an archive of his own, one that filled even the bathrooms and reached to the ceilings of his small Florida home. He used some of that research to find shipwrecks himself. By many accounts, he was as fine a treasure hunter in the water as he was in the stacks in Seville. But perhaps Haskins' greatest contributions came from the groundbreaking research he did that helped lead to the discovery of the galleons Atocha, Concepcion, Tolosa, Guadalupe, San Jose, and Maravilla. Many thought Haskins had never received the credit or treasure he deserved. At times, his finances had run so low he'd been forced to sell his scuba gear. Supporters urged him to fight for his rights, sue, throw a punch, anything. Attorneys offered to take his cases for free. But he'd seen enough combat on PT boats in World War II, and he was a gentle soul. Instead of fighting, he returned to the archives, finding things no one else could find, diving his own wrecks, selling enough antique coins to survive. Now, almost 80, he was renowned in the world of treasure, not just for his ability to find valuable shipwrecks, but for his instinct to forgive those who'd wronged him. Matera ordered a piece of key lime pie and sat back and listened to Haskins talk treasure. "Modern gold and silver," Haskins said, "could not compare in beauty or presence to the old gold and silver found on galleons, which had been mined using mercury, a dangerous process no longer permitted but which produced a remarkable purity. The imperfection of handmade early Spanish coins, or cobs, no two were exactly alike, made discovery endlessly interesting. The amounts of contraband carried by some treasure ships still staggered Haskins' imagination."
"But I know you want to talk about pirates," Haskins said. "Why don't you follow me home and we'll do that? I want to show you a few things."
Matera pulled into the driveway of a modest house built on stilts, a must in the flood-prone area. A narrow set of stairs led to the front door, which Haskins climbed carefully. There was no railing, so he held the side of the house for support. Inside, copies of centuries-old Spanish documents towered high in every room, hundreds of thousands of pages written in a near-indecipherable hand. There was little else in the place, not even a television.
"I married once. Briefly. Never had any kids," Haskins said. "Mostly it's been just me, my cats, and my research."
Every few minutes Haskins picked a random page from a random box and read aloud to Matera about cargo lost from a doomed galleon, the worries of a captain on the eve of his journey back to Spain, the accounts of survivors who had seen their loved ones vanish during storms. All of them came from the logs of treasure ships, many still out there waiting to be found. In the kitchen, Haskins poured Matera a cup of coffee.
"You're working in Samanan looking for a pirate," Haskins said. "Which means you must be looking for our friend Mr. Bannister."
Matera smiled. "You know about Bannister?" Haskins did. He'd come across mention of the pirate and his ship, the Golden Fleece, while researching the Concepcion. He'd even done research in Seville on the wreck, just as Matera had the previous week. That alone made Matera feel like he was playing in the big leagues. But it worried him, too. If a historian like Haskins couldn't track down Bannister's ship, what chance did he have on his own?
"What can I do, Jack?" Matera asked. "I'm running out of ideas."
Haskins sipped from his coffee and thought it over. Shipwreck research, he said, wasn't just about looking through books and records. In the case of Spanish galleons, it was about understanding the nature of the target, the treasure ship, why she sailed, when she did, what she feared, the shortcuts she used, the chances she took. In the case of the Golden Fleece, perhaps it meant understanding the same things about a pirate ship. Haskins showed Matera more documents and maps he'd acquired over a lifetime of research, then walked Matera back to his car. Standing in the driveway, the men shook hands. Matera needed to leave. He could see Haskins was tired, but he couldn't go without asking one last question.
"Do you feel like you got ripped off all these years, Jack?"
For a moment, Haskins didn't reply. Then he smiled.
"I just loved the wrecks."
Matera's next appointment, the following morning, was a 3-hour drive north of Key Largo, but he was eager to make it. 75-year-old Bob Marks was one of the most successful treasure hunters ever. A former Marine, underwater archaeologist, and the author of dozens of books on treasure and shipwrecks, he listed nearly 100 major discoveries on his curriculum vitae, and that was just the short version of the document. By turns bombastic, brilliant, and profane, he'd discovered, among other things, the sunken city of Port Royal, Jamaica, the Spanish galleon Nuestra Señora de las Maravillas, lost Mayan temples in the jungles of Central America, and ancient Phoenician ports and wrecks in Lebanon. Few men knew more about shipwreck hunting, or had seen more of the business, than Marks. He'd recovered millions of dollars in treasure, lectured in more than 40 countries, and been knighted by the Spanish government for sailing in a replica of Columbus's ship, the Niña, from Spain to San Salvador, a journey that had risked his life. When customers purchased his treasure, they received a certificate of authenticity signed Sir Robert Marks. In recent months, Matera had become friendly with Marks, but it hadn't always been that way. In 1998, Marks had insulted Matera, whom he did not know, at a book signing. Years later, when Marks showed up at a dive conference Matera was sponsoring in the Dominican Republic, Matera told him,
"You're too old for me to punch you in the face, Bob, but I can still yell at you," and gave him an uncensored piece of his mind.
To Matera's surprise, Marks apologized for the long-ago incident. That meant a lot to Matera, given that he owned 28 of Marks's books and considered him a pioneer, and that Marks clearly didn't remember the event. But that was a long time ago. Now Marks was waiting for him in the driveway and waving him in.
"Are you packing?"
Marks asked. He wanted to know if Matera had brought a gun.
"Yeah, it's in the glove compartment."
"Good. We might need it. There's some crazy bastard after me. Don't ask why. Just bring the piece."
Marks was a hero to Matera, so he did as he was asked. The men walked up a pathway lined with shards of ancient pottery, the detritus of countless Marks scores.
"In the old days, everyone in the treasure business lived within about 2 or 3 miles of right here," Marks said. "I don't care if you worked in the Bahamas, Florida, Cuba, you were based here. All the astronauts were involved. Hot Lips Houlihan from MASH, you name it. This was the place to be."
Inside the house, Marks introduced his wife and co-author, Jennifer. Matera had read her work and spoken to her on the phone. If anything, she was even more impressive than her husband. The couple wanted to show Matera around the house, but he stood frozen in the dining room. He stared at a bronze disc about the size of a grapefruit resting on a high shelf.
"There it is," Matera said.
The mariner's astrolabe predated the sextant and had been used as early as the late 1300s to determine latitude at sea. Coveted by treasure hunters, archaeologists, collectors, and museums, a single example could fetch as much as $500,000 at auction. Marks had a dozen of them lined up beside the one Matera was beholding. And that was just the start of the treasures Matera observed on his way to the kitchen. A piece of pre-Ming Dynasty China, circa 1200, with delicate dancing dolphins, pristine olive jars taken from sunken galleons, a jade burial suit that dated, by Matera's estimation, to around 200 BC, used to bury royal members of China's Han Dynasty. Matera couldn't begin to calculate the value of that piece, if a value could be placed on it at all. The men walked outside and crossed a small path to Marx's office, which had once been the slave quarters on an old sugar plantation. Here, Matera saw an even better kind of treasure. tens of thousands of books on double-deep shelves that seemed to stretch forever.
"Don't touch those horses,"
Marks called out when Matera moved past sculptures recovered from a centuries-old Portuguese ship.
"They're 100 grand apiece. Don't fucking break them."
On a bench near Marx's desk, Matera saw a copy of a coffee table book about Marx's discovery of ancient Phoenician artifacts. On a nearby table, he saw hundreds of those very artifacts, and others, millennia old, laid out on display.
"I'll sell you whatever you want," Marx said. "Friends and family price. I'll throw in a certificate of authenticity, too. There's an X-rated section in the back. The ancients loved that shit."
For the next several hours, Marx told stories about treasure hunters, past and present. Each was laced with adventure and close calls, but most of them underlined what Marx had said decades earlier.
"Treasure is trouble,"
a line that had become gospel in the business. Outsiders took the saying to mean that treasure hunters usually ended up broke, which was true, but not what Marx meant. The trouble he was referring to resided in the hearts of the unlucky few who found treasure, to the weight that gold and silver placed on the soul. Time and again through history, treasure turned honorable men greedy and brought out the worst in the well-intentioned. Just the sight of it caused reasonable people to sever marriages, friendships, and partnerships, to cheat investors, to fight for more than their fair share. In this way, gold and silver performed alchemies of their own. By mixing with human instinct, they could turn even the pious base. Matera could have listened to Marx's stories all day, but he'd come to talk about pirates, and he pressed Marx on the subject. Marx, in fact, had mentioned Bannister and the Golden Fleece briefly in one of his books, and now Matera wanted to know more.
"There's no map or secret instructions for finding the Golden Fleece," Marx said. "If you're going to get her, you've got to understand what these guys were doing. You've got to know the pirates."
Marx himself had come to learn a lot about piracy when, in 1964, he fulfilled a childhood dream by salvaging the sunken city of Port Royal, Jamaica, the fabled pirate haven lost in an earthquake in 1692. It was in Port Royal that Bannister had stolen his own ship and turned pirate. It was from Port Royal that the manhunt for him had been directed.
"Pirates from all over the world went to Port Royal," Marx said. "Big things were happening there. Your guy was part of all that. He was there in its heyday. That's got to tell you something."
Matera spent the rest of the afternoon talking to Marx, absorbing his stories. In late afternoon, the men went to another of Marx's offices in town, where the old treasure hunter showed photographs from his career. By the time they left, it was near dark, but Marx was still going strong as ever, limping from gout as they made their way to the car, still firing off profanity-pocked stories of treasure derring-do. It was clear to Matera that the man would never retire. The treasure was not something Marx did, but rather something he was. Like William Phipps in the late 1600s, Marx seemed to exist on confidence, on an inborn instinct to take rather than ask from the sea. Retire? And do what? Take a Perillo bus tour of Europe? Get an early bird price on a meal? In the end, Matera thought, it didn't matter if guys like Marx got too old to actually find the stuff. They weren't really in it for the treasure. In the end, they seemed in it to set sail, to search for things others didn't dare look for, to be Sir Robert instead of Bob. Matera had one more appointment to keep. In ways, he looked forward to this one most of all. Carl Fismer had a reputation for being a maestro in a business full of great storytellers. He was also known for his honesty and integrity. As with Haskins, his close friend, it had probably cost him several fortunes. He'd worked on some important wrecks, including Concepcion. And he'd worked in Samana Bay. Many said that Fizz knew even more about human nature than about treasure. Generations of salvors knew Fizz's story. He'd worked for General Motors in Cincinnati, but despised it. Every day seemed the same to him there. He moved to Florida in 1968, after his wife, who'd been his high school sweetheart, was killed in an automobile accident. She was just 26. Punching the clock didn't feel right to Fizz after that. He gathered his two young children, packed his car, and drove south. In Sarasota, he joined the fire department, the closest thing he could find to a paying adventure. Practicing body recovery on a fireboat, he came across a shipwreck, a small freighter busted open and showing its copper pipes. Fizz and the other firemen salvaged what they could. In the end, the haul netted the men a total of $6.40, but the idea that he could take money from water inspired Fizz. And from that day, he was hooked. For months, he visited every library and bookstore within a day's drive of Sarasota, reading everything he could on Spanish galleons and sunken treasure. He built his own magnetometer, a hodgepodge of transistors and wires that turned out to be better at picking up local radio stations than metal, but it just made him hungrier still. For 6 years, he searched the waters near Sarasota, but found almost nothing. Only then, at age 36, did he drive to the Keys, not to go looking for treasure, but to find the man who had practically invented the hunt. Art McKee was considered the grandfather of American treasure hunting. He'd found several Spanish galleons in Florida waters in the 1940s, part of the fabled 1733 fleet, and had been featured in Life magazine, on The Dave Garraway Show, and in newspapers, magazines, and newsreels. Before McKee, few in America knew that real-life treasure hunters existed. McKee had built a treasure museum next to his house in Isla Mirada, and that's where Fizz found him, riding on a lawnmower. By now, McKee was in his 60s. "I want to be a treasure hunter," Fizz told him, "and I'm willing to work for free to learn the business."
"I bet you're a diver," McKee said.
"Yes, sir."
"What else can you do? Are you a boat captain, a mechanic? Have medical training? Can you cook?"
"No, none of that."
"Everyone's a diver, got too many of those."
Fizz got into his car and drove back to Sarasota, where he enrolled in an emergency medical technician course, earned his boat captain's license, learned to work on small engines, and volunteered to cook for 15 firemen a day at the firehouse. 2 years later, he drove back to Isla Mirada, where he found McKee again on the lawnmower. "I'm Carl Fizmer. I want to be a treasure hunter, and I'm willing to work for free to learn the business."
"I bet you're a diver."
"Yes, sir."
"What else can you do?"
"I'm a boat captain. I fix small engines. I'm a state-certified paramedic, and I cook. Meatloaf is my specialty."
"Good. You're on my next trip."
And with that, Fizz began to learn from the master. It was the start of a career that would take him on adventures across the world. Matera found Fizz's address in Tavernier, a small town about 7 miles south of Key Largo, and knocked at the door of a small house beside a winding canal. A stocky, tanned, and handsome 68-year-old man answered the door. He sported a neatly trimmed gray beard, Hawaiian shirt, khaki shorts, and deck shoes, and a heavy silver coin around his neck.
"Come on in and let's talk shipwrecks."
Matera looked around. On every shelf, atop the television, behind the coffee maker, he saw shipwreck artifacts. On the TV stand, he spotted a silver coin, its date clearly marked, 1639.
"That's the second best coin I ever found," said Fizz.
"I'm guessing the best one is around your neck."
"You guess good."
Fizz knew Matera wanted to discuss pirates, so they sat at the kitchen table, where Fizz said the best stories got told.
"Let me hear what you got," Fizz said.
And Matera told him the story, about Bannister and the Golden Fleece, about searching Samana Bay with Chatterton, about doing exhaustive research in libraries, archives, antiquarian bookstores, and rare map dealers.
"I'm lost, Fizz. I don't know what to do next."
Fizz got Matera a beer.
"What are you best at, John?"
"What do you mean?"
"What do you love doing when you're looking for a wreck? Is it the survey work? Diving? Digging? What gets you?"
"It's the history, the research."
"Then you need to keep doing that."
But Matera had already done months of research and read everything he could find, and he told Fizz so. That's when Fizz told him a story about Jack Haskins. Like many treasure hunters in the late 1960s, Haskins had been working to find the Atocha, A Spanish galleon sunk off the Florida Keys in 1622. For centuries, salvors believed the ship to be lost off the village of Isla Mirada in the central Florida Keys, but no one could find a trace of her there. So Haskins, a historian in his heart, went to Seville. He threw himself into the stacks there, unearthing thousands of pages of documents, many of which hadn't been handled since the 17th century. He spent years going through the papers, but never found anything that helped further the search.
"That's when most guys would have given up," said Fizz, "but not Jack."
Haskins kept reading, even the most obscure papers, ones that didn't even seem worth the price of a photocopy in Seville. One day, he ran across a single sentence buried in one of those thousands of papers. It mentioned a place called Marquesas Keys, off Key West, about 80 miles from where most treasure hunters in search of the Atocha were working at the time. Haskins shared that information, it was his nature to share, and it helped lead treasure hunter and former chicken rancher Mel Fisher to the wreck. Soon, the Atocha became the most famous treasure ship of all time.
"She's been worth half a billion so far," Fizz said. "Jack got almost nothing, but that's another story. One of the richest treasure wrecks ever was found because he never gave up on those papers."
The first fishing boats began returning to dock, so the men went out on Fizz's screened porch to watch them come in. They talked for hours, Fizz telling stories from a lifetime in the business, and in the cracks and unspoken spaces, Matera heard subtext. And this is what he took Fizz to be saying. "Treasure shows who you really are. It strips away every facade you've constructed, every story you believe about yourself, and reveals the real you. If you are a miserable, lying, greedy, worthless fuck, treasure will tell you that. If you are a good and decent person, treasure will tell you that too. And you needn't find a single coin to know. It's enough to get close to treasure, to believe it within reach, and you'll have your answer. But once it happens, it can't be lied about, and it can't be bullshitted away. For that reason, treasure is crisis, because what you get in the end is yourself." When the men finally got up to say goodbye, Matera asked about the coin on Fizz's necklace. Fizz pulled it from his shirt. It was an 8 escudo from Concepcion, a wreck he loved because it had been lost twice to history, but never abandoned. Driving over long bridges back to his hotel, Matera watched the keys disappear behind him. Local joints such as Craig's Restaurant and Doc's Diner giving way to Starbucks and Denny's. His time with the Oracles had come to an end, and though none of the men could show him to Bannister's wreck, each had pointed him in the same direction, to history, and they told him not to let go. Chapter 11. The Golden Age. A weathered ship sails through the Caribbean in the late 17th century. Chicken coops and empty barrels cluttered about her decks, a handful of rough-hewn crewmen scrubbing, painting, and unwinding rolls of line. Aloft in the masts, a lone sailor scans the seas, looking for others. Late in the day, the lookout spots the white sails of a smaller vessel in the distance, and soon he can make out her flag. English. He calls for his captain, who trains his looking glass. He can see that she carries 6 cannons, typical of a merchant vessel, but he is even more interested in whether she rides high or low on the water. This one rides very low, meaning she is full of cargo, and to this captain, that is what matters. The captain issues orders, and his crew snaps into action. 2 of the men open a chest containing a collection of flags from around the world, fish out the English red ensign, and hoist it to the top of their mast. 3 others dress in women's clothing and begin sauntering around the bow. Below decks, 130 men arm themselves with weapons and explosives. At the helm, the captain orders his ship to set course, slowly, for the merchant ship in the distance. By now, the merchant ship captain is looking back through his own telescope. He is excited to see the red English flag in the distance. This is his 40-man crew's chance to trade supplies, exchange stories, and share drinks with fellow countrymen. But he is wary, too. He is carrying a valuable cargo of silver, sugar, and indigo, and knows that pirates hunt in these shipping lanes. So the merchant captain keeps watching the English vessel.